The subject inspires in me an entirely different sort of anxiety than talking about Callum. I requested an appointment with the hospital governors.
To be admitted as a patient?
No, to make a petition to study medicine there. Though they don't know that's what I want to talk to them about. I may have implied the meeting would be to discuss a financial donation I wanted to make to the hospital. I scrape my teeth over my bottom lip. It sounds far worse when I say it aloud, particularly to St. Percy. Should I not have done that? He shrugs.
You could have picked a less dramatically different reason. They're all going to wrench their necks from the shift in topic.
It was the only way I could be sure they'd see me. Nowhere in Edinburgh will have me as a student, not any of the hospitals or the private physicians or teachers. I'd have to leave eventually if I want schooling and a license. I let my head fall forward so that it's resting against the headboard of the bed. I didn't realise it would be so hard.
To study medicine?
Yes, I think, but also to be a woman alone in the world. My character was forged by independence and self-sufficiency in the face of loneliness, so I assumed the tools for survival were already in my kit. It was just a matter of learning to use them. But not only do I not have the tools, I have no plans and no supplies and seem to be working in a different medium entirely. And because I'm a woman, I'm forced to do it all with my hands tied behind my back. Percy shifts his weight and flinches, a shudder running up his arm and twisting his shoulder. I sit up. Are you all right?
I'm sore. I'm always so sore after a fit.
Did you fall?
No, I was asleep when it happened, in bed. Maybe I wasn't asleep.
He presses the heel of his hand into his forehead.
I don't remember. Sorry, I was feeling awake, but I'm getting fuzzy again, and I can't remember the last thing we talked about.
You should sleep.
Do you mind?
Of course not. I stand up, smoothing out my skirt where it's gotten rucked up over my knees. I am more than capable of entertaining myself. Do you need anything?
I'm all right.
He burrows down into the blankets, the bed frame letting out an ominous creak. The weight of the day settles through me. Exposed to the freezing winds as I rode the Imperial of the coach down from Scotland, reeking of the horses relieving themselves, and the man next to me asking again and again for my name, where I live, why won't I smile? I'm weary and cold, and Percy is a soft place to land. Could I? He opens his eyes. I suddenly feel very small and meek. A child begging to crawl into bed with her mother when she's woken at night by frightful dreams. But I don't even have to ask. He tosses back the quilt and slides over to make room for me. I kick my boots across the floor and strip off my coat, but leave my jumper on, then lie down beside him, pulling the quilt over us both. I roll over onto my back and let the silence settle over us like a fine layer of dust before I say, my face to the ceiling, and not entirely certain Percy's still awake, I've missed you. Both of you. I can hear the soft smile in his voice when he replies,
I won't tell Monty. 3.
The appointment at St. Bart's is confirmed for a week after I arrive in London. Somehow, the address in Moorfields didn't tip them off to the fact that I haven't any spare coinage to be tossing at their establishment. I have a half-hour slot just before they recess for lunch, so they'll all be hungry and irritable and disinclined to rule in my favour. I sleep as well as a girl can hope to the night before a meeting that could change the course of her life, which is to say, I do not sleep at all, but rather lie awake for hours, mentally reviewing the process of lancing boils, like they might quiz me on that one very specific thing I just happened to study, and trying not to let my thoughts spin into hypotheticals of where I would live if they did admit me, or how I'd pay the £50 tuition, or what I would do if my tutors did not subscribe to an anatomist philosophy. When I do fall asleep, it's into dreams of missing my meeting time, or my feet turning to stones as I race toward the assigned room, or the board asking me why I should be allowed to study medicine, and I cannot come up with a single coherent reason.
"Why are you here, Miss Montague?"
they ask, and I can't reply because my throat is clamped shut and my head is empty.
"Why should you be admitted here when you're just a girl, when you're just a child, when this is all just a silly passing fancy?"
The third time I wake from this particular dream, I get up. Monty isn't home yet, and Percy is dead asleep beside me with his head all the way under the blanket, so I risk lighting a candle from the smouldering ashes of the stove. I retrieve my book of Platt's treatises from my knapsack and rip out the final blank page. Then, with a pencil from Percy's music stand, I sit cross-legged on the floor at the foot of the bed and begin to make a list. Reasons I should be allowed to study medicine at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. First, women comprise half the population of this city and the country and have unique afflictions of their sex that male physicians are incapable of understanding or treating effectively. Second, the perspective of a woman on the subject of medicine is an untapped resource in a field dedicated to progress. Third, women have been practicing medicine for hundreds of years and have only been excluded in this country in recent history. Fourth, I can read and write Latin, French, and some German, in addition to English. I am schooled in mathematics and have read widely on subjects related to medicine. My favourite writer is Dr. Alexander Platt, and if you were to present me now with pen and paper, I could draw you a map of the bronchial tree from memory. Also, I recently mended a gentleman's amputated finger with no prior schooling on the subject, and he is expected to recover entirely. Fifth, I want nothing else in the world so much as to know things about the workings of the human body and to improve upon our knowledge and study of them. I frown at the last one. It's a bit overly sentimental and will do nothing to make a case for the stout heart of a woman. It is also not entirely true. I do not want to know things. I want to understand things. I want to answer every question ever posed me. I want to leave no room for anyone to doubt me. Every time I blink or breathe or twitch or stretch, every time I feel pain or awake or alive, I want to know why. I want to understand everything I can about myself in a world that often makes no sense, even if the only things to be known for certain are on a chemical level. I want there to be right answers, and I want to know them, and myself because I know them. I don't know who I am without this. That's the truest thing I could say. Half my heart is this hunger. My being is constructed by an aching to know the answers to every mystery of the frail ligaments that connected us to life and death. That wanting feels a part of me. It has seeped into my skin like mercury injected into a vein to trace its shape through the body. One drop coloured my whole being. It is the only way I can see myself. This, I remind myself, is a fresh start, a new city. Another place to try again and prove that I deserve a spot in this world. I write that at the top, not for the board, but a reminder to myself. You deserve to be here. There's a crash and a curse on the other side of the partition. I startle so fantastically that I accidentally poke the tip of the pencil all the way through the paper, skewering the final E in here. "Monty," I hiss, peering out from behind the partition with my candle raised. I make out the shape of my brother, bent double, massaging his kneecap, which, judging by the clatter, he slammed into the stove.
"This flat's a bloody death trap,"
he says, words fizzing through his clenched teeth.
"What are you doing? It's 4 in the morning.
I look down at the paper mashed between my hands, thinking.
"Can you think in bed with a light out so that I can sleep?"
"Yes,"
Sorry. I crease the paper and shove it into the pocket of my skirt hung upon the partition. Monty watches me, one hand still rubbing his knee.
What were you writing?
Nothing of consequence. The list suddenly feels silly and small, the sermon of an idealistic missionary who has yet to accept that no one cares about her gospel. Just some notes for my appointment.
Are you nervous?
Of course not, I reply. Just wanted to be prepared. I blow out the candle and return to bed before he can ask further. I can hear him rooting around the flat for several minutes longer, dressing for bed. He pauses on the other side of the screen, and I hear the crunch of unfolded paper. There's a silence, then another rustle as it's returned to its place. I don't get up, and he doesn't say anything to me as he gropes his way to bed through the darkness and curls up on Percy's other side. He's snoring in minutes, but I lie awake for hours longer, counting the beats of my heart and repeating to myself over and over, "You deserve to be here." When I wake again, the morning light flitting in through the cracks in the wall is the warm gold of a soft-boiled egg. At my side, Percy is curled up with his knees pulled to his chest, and Monty's head, still swathed in that ridiculous slab of a hat, resting on his chest. It's the same way we sometimes slept on our tour, the nights we all three shoved ourselves into lumpy beds in dodgy inns, or laid out beneath the white poplars in farmers' fields blushing with lavender. I try to make my rising quiet, though the floorboards render that impossible. The whole flat seems to be conspiring against me, for I immediately run into the screen and it nearly collapses. It's a testament to how exhausted they both must be, for Monty continues to drool into Percy's nightshirt, and Percy doesn't stir. There's no room for true privacy in the tiny flat, and though I've shared tighter quarters with these two lads, I'm not about to strip to my skin in the middle of the room and pretend as though my modesty is as easy to put out of sight as it was when we stowed away together in the bowels of a Zeebeck. I managed to change into fresh underthings on the other side of the screen without disrobing entirely, though I bang my elbow hard at least three times on three separate things and almost tip over like a falling tree when I catch my toe in a hole in my petticoat. When I tie my pockets around my waist, I check to make certain the list is still there. It is, though in the right rather than the left where I placed it. Monty remains a terrible thief. The stove is still warm from the night before, but nowhere near enough for it to do anything useful like boil water for coffee or thaw me under my jumper. I throw on a pair of logs and blow until they catch, then wrap myself in my brother's coat before crouching with my back to the belly of the stove, waiting for the heat to become too much to sit so close, and listening for chimes down the road. Though I know from the light it's still early. But it's more comfortable to worry about being late to the meeting than to worry about the meeting itself. There's a creak behind me, first from the bed ropes, then the floorboards, and Percy comes around the screen, wrapped in a battered dressing gown that looks as though it was made in the previous century for a man half his height. His hair is puffed up on one side and flat on the other, and his face is heavy, like he's still waking himself.
"Good morning," he says.
I press a finger to my lips with a meaningful look at where Monty is still asleep, now spread over the entirety of the bed, like he was dropped there from a great height. Percy waves me away.
"He's lying on his good ear. He'd sleep through the end of the world."
"Oh, well then. Good morning. Better today?"
"Much."
He sits down cross-legged in front of the stove, his shoulders curled toward its warmth.
"Why are you up so early? I thought your meeting wasn't until 11.
"Just gathering my thoughts." I resist the urge to reach into my pocket for my list again. "You?"
"My quartet is playing at a luncheon today, and I actually think I might make it through the entire concert without vomiting.
Oh, good. I don't mean to sound upset, but it comes out with a bit of a wilting end. It isn't that I expected him or Monty to come along with me. The most they could offer is silent encouragement from the back of the room, and I've always known I would be doing this alone. Everything I've done up to this point has been alone, but disappointment still knocks against my ribcage. That's all right. Percy looks up. Hmm? I had waited too long to say it, and also he hadn't been apologizing for anything. I shoved down that annoying disappointment, chiding it that it has no business being there. Nothing. I smile at him, then push myself to my feet. Let me make you coffee before I go. I give myself an hour to walk to St. Bart's, though it's only a mile. In addition to a half hour to sit anxiously in the hallway before the scheduled time of the appointment. Percy sees me off at the door with more affirming words, but no hug or even a pat upon the shoulder. Thank God for friends who learn to speak to you in your own language rather than making you learn theirs. I'm already on the street, hood pulled up and hands jammed into my muff and trying to remember to breathe, when I hear the door to their building slam behind me. I turn as Monty stumbles down the stoop, trying to lace one of his boots while still moving forward and doing neither effectively.
Sorry, he calls as he staggers toward me. I swear I was going to be up on time, but I didn't think you'd be leaving so goddamn early.
What are you doing? I ask.
He gives up on the boot and jogs to catch me up, laces dragging in the mud.
I'm coming with you. Someone should make certain you don't get arrested.
He's still got that little tea cozy of a hat on, and he reaches up to pull it down so it's covering his scars as much as possible without it impeding his vision. He notices me staring at it and asks,
"Should I have worn a wig? This seems now like it might be a wig-wearing sort of gathering. I've got one upstairs. I can go fetch it. But it's been growing mould since the fall, and I assumed that wasn't the sort of impression..."
"Thank you," I interrupt. He pauses.
"For not wearing my mouldering wig?"
"Yes, definitely for that. But thank you for coming." He scrubs his hands together and gives a short puff on them for warmth.
"Percy would too, if he could, but he's missed too many shows this week, and epilepsy is, in professional medical terms, a son of a bitch."
I nearly laugh, but then he'll be pleased with himself, and if I have to see those dimples this early, I might punch him. We fall into step together, or rather, as into step as a pair can on these ragged roads. I dart around a puddle of what I'm fairly certain is piss, gathering in the frozen rut of a wagon wheel, then duck around Monty so I'm not on his deaf side.
"You really think I'd let you do this alone, you goose?" he says as we walk. "It's a lot to take on by yourself."
"I've taken on a lot by myself," I reply.
"I'm not saying you're not capable, but it's nice sometimes to have someone to cheer you on. Metaphorically," he adds quickly. "I promise I won't do any actual cheering, even though it's tempting because of how much it would embarrass you."
I glance sideways at him, and he looks at me at the same time. The corners of his mouth start to turn up in the sly triumph of having caught me in a moment of sentimentality, but I toss my head back so my hood shields my face before he can say anything. "That hat is idiotic."
"I know," he says. "Percy made it for me."
"I didn't know Percy knew how to knit."
"He doesn't,"
Monty replies, and the brim of the hat falls in front of his eyes as though in emphasis.
"I'm glad you've got Percy," I say.
"So am I."
As we cross into the square,
the caving tenement houses open into grey sky. The light is a slick sheen over the muddy streets like the scales of a herring.
"And don't be cross with me for saying this, but I wish you had someone too. I worry about you."
"You do not."
"I do."
He dodges a stream of brown water dumped from a high window, and our shoulders bump.
Ask Perth. I wake up in the middle of the night in panic about my lonely sister up in Scotland.
I'm not lonely.
I didn't think I was either.
I shrug so my cloak falls closed in front of me. Do you want me to marry Mr. Doyle because you think I need a man to protect me or complete me? I'll pass on that, thank you very much.
No, he says. I just wish you had someone cheering for you all the time, because you deserve it.
We stop on a street corner, waiting for a flock of sedan chairs to cross the road ahead of us, their footmen calling greetings and japes to each other as they pass. Love has made you terribly soft, you know, I say to him without looking.
I do, he replies. Isn't it grand?
4. At 11 o'clock, Monty and I are shown into St. Bartholomew's Great Hall by a spotty adolescent clerk with too much powder cracking along his hairline. It's a high-ceilinged, gold-leafed room with two levels of windows framed by dark wooden plaques, the names of donors painted in long, neat rows. Men. All of them men. A portrait of St. Bartholomew hangs over a marble mantelpiece, his blue robe one of the only spots of colour in the dark room. It would be more impressive if we had not walked through the filthy hospital ward where haggard nurses shook lice out of grey linens, buckets of waste were carried out by patients forced to work to earn their keep, and a man I assumed was a surgeon screamed at a woman about using the name of the Lord in vain to get here. The hallways reeked of sickness, intertwined with the sharp metallic tang from the meat market it adjoins. All this grandeur seems like appalling waste. But I'm here. My heart hiccups. I am about to speak to a board of hospital governors. I've never made it this far before. There are a few rows of chairs lined up before a tall wooden bench, behind which sit the governors. Them I do find impressive, though aside from their wigs and fine clothes, it's likely to do with the fact that they are men in a large group, which always ignites a sort of primal fear in me. Flanked as they are by busts of the governors before them, and loomed over by all those names along the walls, I feel generations of men who have kept women from their schools staring me down. Men like this never die. They're chiselled in marble and erected in these halls. Monty settles himself in one of the chairs and puts his feet up on the one in front of him. The clerk nearly faints. I consider chiding him, but I would rather my first impression with these men not be that of a stern governess correcting her overgrown man-child on his manners. While I, in tartan and wool and work boots, am in no place to be casting judgment upon anyone's fashion, his trousers have more holes than I noticed on the walk here, one distressingly near a sensitive area. He could have gone to a bit more effort not to look waifish. I lay my winter things over the chair beside him, fish my notations out from my pocket, and resist the urge to wear out all my anxiety on its corners as I take my place before the board. None of whom look at me. Rather, they're speaking to one another, or going through the forms in front of them. One of them is discussing what he's going to eat for his luncheon today. Another laughs at a joke from his fellow about their horse-racing bets. I feel small enough without being made to wait for them to decide they're ready to address me, so I speak first. "Good morning, gentlemen." Perhaps not the best strategy, but it gets their attention. That, and Monty hisses a hush from the back like we're in school. I almost turn to glare at him, so much for the promise of not embarrassing me. But the men are starting to look my way. They're all old, all of them fair-skinned and robust. At the centre of the table, the gentleman with the largest wig folds his hands and surveys me.
"Miss Montague. Good morning."
I take a breath, and it sticks in my throat like cold porridge. "Good morning, gentlemen." And then I realize I have already said that, and nearly turn on my heel and dash from the room in panic. "You are Felicity Montague," I remind myself as I take another porridgey breath. "You have sailed with pirates and robbed tombs and held a human heart in your hands and sewn your brother's face back together after he got it shot off over said human heart. You have read De Humani Corporis Fabrica 3 times, twice in Latin, and you can name all the bones in the body. And you deserve to be here. You deserve to be here." I glance down at where it's written upon the top of my list. "You deserve to be here. You deserve to exist. You deserve to take up space in this world of men." My heart begins to even itself out. I take a breath, and it doesn't stick. I push up my spectacles and look at the board. And then, of course, I say, "Good morning," one more time. One of the governors snorts, the same mutton-faced man who was boasting about the chops he was about to eat as soon as they're finished here, and it sets off a flare inside me. I square my shoulders, raise my chin, and say with as much confidence as I can muster, "I have come today to petition the board on the matter of granting me permission to study medicine at St. Bartholomew's Hospital." I glance down at my notes again, ready to launch into my first argument with only a small reminder of what that argument is. But the wigged chairman, who seems to speak for the group, interrupts.
"I'm sorry. I must have the wrong appointment."
When I look up, he's flipping through his papers.
"I was told that this was to discuss a donation. Higgins?"
"No, sir, that's right," I say, nearly knocking Higgins, the clerk, out cold as I throw up an arm to halt his scurry forward from the back of the room. The chairman looks at me, and I amend. "I mean, it's not right."
"Are you Miss Felicity Montague?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you scheduled this appointment to discuss a financial donation you wish to be made from a late relative's estate?"
"Yes, sir, but that was a pretense, in order for the board to see me."
"So there's no money," the chops man whispers to his neighbour.
The chairman folds his hands and leans forward over them, his eyes narrowing.
"You felt the need to seek refuge in a pretense?"
"Only because I have made appeals to several different boards at several different hospitals and not been granted permission to make my plea."
"And what plea would that be?"
I resist the urge to glance down at my paper, just for somewhere to look that isn't into those hawk-black eyes of a man who has never been denied anything in his life. "I would ask the board's permission to be granted a chance to study medicine at the hospital, with the intention of obtaining a post and license to practice." I had expected laughter from the board. Instead, they're looking back and forth at one another, as though questioning whether the others are also seeing this terrier of a girl who dares to ask them for the moon, or if she's simply a figment of their pre-luncheon hunger pangs.
"I can show her out, sir," Higgins says, and I jump.
Somehow he snuck up to my shoulder without my noticing and is already reaching to take me by the arm.
"Not yet,"
the chairman replies. My fist closes involuntarily around my notes, crushing them. That "yet" raises my hackles, as though my being thrown from this room is merely a matter of time.
"Miss Montague,"
he says, his tone the auditory equivalent of looking down his nose, which he is also doing as he's seated higher than me.
"Why do you think you have previously been denied a chance to petition a hospital board on this matter?"
It's a snare of a question, one that I know I have to walk into, or he'll lead me in circles until I trip it, and I'd rather not be led anywhere. My chin rises. If I raise my head any higher, they'll be staring up my nose. And I say, "Because I am a woman."
"Precisely."
He looks down the bench and says,
"So, that's our recess, gentlemen. We'll reconvene here at 2.
The men begin to stand up, reaching for their cloaks and gathering their cases and papers and all talking at full volume.
I feel Higgins behind me, closing in to make good on that yet. He actually gets his bony little fingers around my arm this time, but I shake him off before he can get a good grip. I take a few steps forward and say, as loudly as I can without shouting, "You haven't heard my case!" The chairman tosses his cloak over his shoulders and gives me a smile that he likely thinks is kind, but is, in fact, the smirk of a man about to explain something to a woman that she already knows.
"There's nothing more to hear. Your case is contained within that single statement. You are a woman, Miss Montague, and women are not permitted to study at the hospital. It's our policy."
I take another step toward the bench. "That policy is antiquated and foolish, sir."
"Antiquated is quite a large word, madam," he says.
So is patronizing, I think, but bite my tongue. Most of the board is listening again now. I have a sense that, more than anything, they're hoping to have a good story to share at the pub, but I'll take any attention I'm offered.
"Have you previously studied medicine at a hospital or academic institution?" the chairman asks.
"No, sir."
"Have you had any kind of formal schooling?"
He's baiting the water again, and the best I can do is sidestep. "I was educated at home, and I've read quite a lot of books."
"That isn't healthy for you," one of the other men interrupts. "Reading in excess causes the female brain to shrink."
"Oh, for God's sake," I burst out, my temper snatching the reins. "You can't actually believe that."
The man leans backward as though I've frightened him, but another leans in to add,
"If you've read so many books, why do you need a hospital education?"
"Because a hospital education is required in order to obtain licensure and establish a practice," I say. "And because reading Alexander Platt's treatise on human bones is not adequate preparation for setting a broken leg when the wound is bloody and the bone has splintered under the skin and already starting to fester with gangrene." I had hoped Dr. Platt's name would conjure something closer to adoration among the men, but instead, a low murmur ripples through them. A man on the end with a pointed chin and tufts of coarse blonde hair sticking out from under his wig raises his eyebrows.
"Then let a man set that bone, and let the woman see the injured has a good meal and a bed,"
the chops man murmurs, loud enough for everyone to hear. There's a smattering of laughter from these men with clean fingernails who hardly know the colour of blood. The chairman flicks his gaze in their direction, but does nothing to silence them.
"Miss Montague,"
he says, his eyes returning to mine,
"I have no doubt that you are very bright for a young lady, but even if we were to consider admitting a female to our student ranks, the cost of necessary arrangements for her..."
"What arrangements, sir?" I demand.
"Well, to begin, she would be unable to attend anatomy dissections."
"Why? Do you think my nerves so weak and fragile that I could not handle the sight? The women on the streets of London witness more death and dying in a single day than you likely have in your lifetime."
"I have yet to meet a woman with a stomach for the sort of dissections we undertake," he says, "not to mention the nakedness of the male form, which would be inappropriate for you to see outside the bonds of marriage."
He glances over my shoulder at Monty, who raises his hand and says, "Brother," as though that's the most important matter to set straight here. I resist throwing something over my head and hoping it catches him in the nose, and instead remain focused on the chairman. "I can assure you, sir, I would not become hysterical."
"You seem hysterical now."
"I'm not," I say, annoyed that my voice pitches on the second word. "I'm speaking passionately."
"Not to mention the concessions that would have to be made so the male students would not be distracted by the presence of a woman,"
one of the other men adds, and the rest of the board nods in support of what an excellent nonsense point he has made. It takes every ounce of strength in me not to roll my eyes. "Well then,
You might consider covering up table legs, lest the mere reminder of the existence of the female form send your students into an erotic frenzy.
Madam,
the chairman begins, and I can feel Higgins right over my shoulder again, but I press on, using my argument as a plough this time. Women make up more than half the population of this city, this country, and the world. Their intelligence and ideas are an untapped resource, particularly in a field that claims such a commitment to progress. There is no proof women are unequipped to study medicine. Quite the contrary. Women have been practicing medicine for hundreds of years and have only been excluded in recent history as surgery became regulated by institutions run by men. Institutions that are now so bogged down in bureaucracy that they have ceased to serve even their most basic functions for those in need. I hadn't planned to say that, but the stink of the hospital wards is still in the back of my throat. The chairman's eyebrows have risen so high they're about to disappear under his wig, but I press on. You make money off the poor and the sick. You charge them to take up space in your hospital wards. You make them work to earn their keep, so less salaried staff is required. You charge absurd amounts for treatments you know don't work so that you can fund research you refuse to share with those who need it. It is perhaps not the wisest thing to insult the institution in which I'm standing, but I've so much rage bottled up inside me about so many things, and it's all pouring from me in a spurt, like shaken champagne violently uncorked. In addition, I say, there are elements of feminine health that male physicians are not equipped to address and have made no attempt to understand or improve treatments for. Would you deny your mothers and sisters and daughters the most effective medical care?
There are no treatments women are denied because of their sex, the chairman interrupts. We treat female patients here the same as we treat men.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a lack of any research to provide relief from the debilitating pain that regularly restricts the most basic tasks of daily life for women.
I don't know what you're referencing, madam,
the chairman says, his voice raised over mine. I'm talking about menstruation, sir, I shout in return. It's like I set the hall on fire, manifested a venomous snake from thin air, also set that snake on fire, and then threw it at the board. The men all erupt into protestations and a fair number of horrified gasps. I swear one of them actually swoons at the mention of womanly bleeding. Higgins snatches his hand back from my shoulder. The chairman has gone bright red. He slams a book against the desk, trying to cram a lid over the Pandora's box I have flung open.
Miss Montague! We'll hear no more protestations from you. Based on your insubstantial and, frankly, hysterical case made before us today, I could not in good conscience allow you to enroll as a student here. You can see yourself out, or I'll have Higgins escort you.
I want to stay. I want to keep fighting them. I want to be allowed to finish the points upon my list. I want to tell them how I stole medical treatises from the bookshop in Chester because the seller wouldn't let me buy them, how I cut the pages out so carefully and reconstructed them into the binding of Eliza Haywood's amatory fiction to hide what I was actually reading after my mother found a copy of Anatomical Exercise on the Motion of the Heart and Blood in Animals in my bedroom and threw it in the fire without a word to me. How sometimes the only reason I feel like I belong to myself, and not the world, is because I understand the way blood moves through my body. I also want to cry, or shout, that I hope all their genitals sprout wings and fly away, or perhaps travel back in time to the start of the meeting and go about this whole thing differently. I want to shut up the small, nasty voice in my head, whispering that maybe they're right, and maybe I am unsuited for this, and maybe I am hysterical, because even though I don't think I am, it's hard to be raised in a world where you're taught to always believe what men say without doubting yourself at every step. Before Higgins can at last get a good grip on my arm, I push past him, not waiting for Monty or looking backward at the governors or the Great Hall. I've never wanted to be away from somewhere so badly in all my life. Outside, the winter air is a welcome slap across my burning face. I plough through the hospital courtyard, past the line at the dispensary, and the nurses emptying sludgy buckets into the gutter, until I'm through the gates and out on the street. The cold has pried the tears from my eyes, though it's easier to blame them on the winter than humiliation. I stop on the pavement so suddenly that I force a sedan to redirect its course. A dog on the lead of a vagrant growls at me. I pull my sleeves up over my hands and press them against my face, my nails digging hard into my forehead. A gust of wind carries a sprinkling of snow off the hospital wall and deposits it on the back of my neck. It feels greasy and clogged with soot, but I let it melt in a slow trickle down my spine, imagining each vertebra as it passes, counting bones with every breath. Running footsteps slap the stones behind me. I drop my hands from my face as Monty comes barreling out of the gates, stopping short when he realizes I haven't made it any farther than that. My cloak and muff, abandoned back in the great hall, are slung over his arm. He extends them to me, and when I don't move to take them, he makes an awkward toss of the cloak around my shoulders. He starts to wedge the muff in between my elbows, rethinks it when he realizes how close this puts him to accidentally grabbing my breast, and instead lets his hands fall, the muff hanging limp at his side. We look at each other. The city boils around us. I want to strike flint and set it aflame, burn everything from the sky down and start the world over.
"Well," Monty says at last.
Then again,
"Well, that didn't go quite as planned."
"It went exactly as I planned," I say, my voice a snap like a rib cracking.
"Really? That was your ideal scenario?"
"I said what I wanted to." I snatch my muff from him and shove my hands into it. "Every point I made is irrefutable. Their exclusionary policies rest entirely on the fragility of their own masculinity, but it doesn't matter because they're men and I'm a woman, so it's not even going to be a fight, and it was never going to be a fight. It was always going to be them walking all over me, and I was stupid to think it could ever be anything more than that, and don't you dare try to hug me!" His arms, which had been rising, freeze mid-air, and he lets them hover there, like he's carrying something large and round and invisible.
"I wasn't going to."
I swipe the back of my hand over my eyes, knocking my spectacles askew. I want so badly to be away from here, but I've got nowhere to run to. Not back to their flat, too small for me to have a good private cry. Even the fact that it's their flat reminds me how much more together my brother's life is than mine. Not back to Edinburgh, into the arms of a man who smells like bread and aniseed, and says he likes me for my spirit, but wants it broken just enough that he can take me out in public. Not back to my parents' house, where I grew up unacknowledged by anyone, unless it was to voice some disapproval for the way I dressed and spoke and brought books with me to parties. For all my efforts, I haven't even a bed of my own to throw myself upon and sob.
"Miss Montague,"
someone says behind me, and I turn too quickly, for a tear rips itself loose from my eye and sets a course down my cheek. One of the governors is standing behind me, the man with the ill-fitting wig who gave me an eyebrow wiggle at the mention of Dr. Platt. His cloak is thrown over his arm and he's breathing fast, a bit of a wheeze to his lungs that sounds like a lingering winter cold. I can feel that tear sitting against the corner of my mouth, and I'm not certain if wiping it away will make its presence more or less noticeable, so I leave it there.
"Good day, sir."
He scrubs his hands together, an uncertain gesture that seems to be both an attempt to generate warmth and also just something to do.
"That was quite a scene,"
he says, and my heart sinks.
"You don't have to put it like that, mate,"
Monty interrupts. He's reaching out for me again, like he intends to put a protective and brotherly arm around my shoulders. I glare at him, and he turns it into brushing some invisible dust off my arm.
My apologies.
The governor extends a hand to me.
Dr. William Cheselden.
Oh. In spite of how sour I'm feeling toward all men in medicine, I go a bit light-headed at hearing the name. I've read your paper on lithotomy.
Have you?
He looks surprised, as though my entire presentation in the Great Hall was a fabrication.
What did you think of it?
I think your method is undeniably better for removing bladder stones, I reply, then add, but I wonder why you wouldn't devote more energy to the study of how to reduce their occurrence altogether, rather than removing them once they've already caused pain. He stares at me, his mouth slightly open and his head canting to the side. I'm ready to turn and walk away, nursing the satisfaction that I was able to tell off at least one of the St. Bart's governors. But then he smiles.
You subscribe to Alexander Platt's School of Preventative Medicine?
Emphatically, I reply, though I've had very little chance to apply anything practically.
Of course.
He slaps his gloves against his palm, then says,
I wanted to offer my apologies for the ungentlemanly way you were treated just now. Some men seem to think that if a lady behaves in a way that they consider unbecoming of her sex, they are justified in speaking in a way that is unbecoming of theirs. So first, my apologies.
I nod, not sure what more I can say other than, thank you.
Second, I wish to offer you a few suggestions.
Suggestions, I repeat.
If your heart is set upon studying medicine, you might seek an apprenticeship with an herbalist or a midwife.
I'm not interested in either of those subjects.
But they are.
He drags out his thought with a hum through pursed lips, then finishes
adjacent to medicine.
So is body snatching, and yet you aren't suggesting I become a grave robber. The tip of his nose is going red from the cold.
Perhaps employment as a nurse at the hospital, then. They're always looking for young women here, and at Bethlehem. I'd be happy to put in a word.
I fold my arms. You mean spooning soup into mouths of invalids and sweeping up the wards after the surgeons walk through it? I had not woken today thinking I would get in an argument with a famous physician, but if I wanted to cook for men, I'd have stayed in Edinburgh and married Callum. I don't want to be a midwife or a nurse.
You're so determined to become a lady doctor, then, he says.
No, sir, I reply. I'm determined to become a doctor. The matter of my sex, I would prefer to be incidental rather than an amendment. He sighs, then it comes out round with a chuckle.
It's a shame you weren't here a few weeks ago, Miss Montague. I would have handed you off to Alexander Platt. You two would get on famously.
Even knowing that it is anatomically impossible in relation to my continued state of living, I swear my heart actually stops. Alexander Platt, as in the author of Treatise on the Anatomy of Human Bones, as in Alexander Platt, my idol, the working-class surgeon among all these wigged fops who man the hospitals, Alexander Platt, who was discharged from his post as a Navy surgeon for his tireless campaign for anatomical dissections to better understand what killed men on the sea. Alexander Platt, who cut his teeth and dirtied his hands walking hospital wards in the French Antilles before he ever was allowed to set foot in an Edinburgh hospital. Alexander Platt, whose work on arsenic poisoning earned him a spot as a visiting lecturer in Padua when he was just 22. Alexander Platt, who had proved one did not need money or a title to be a physician, just a good brain and a determination to use it. Cheselden beams.
The same. He was here last month.
Giving lectures, I ask.
No, it's a rather unfortunate situation. He had his license suspended several years ago and...
Well, it's all a very sticky business. He laughs, too high, his eyes darting away from mine before he finishes. But he was here seeking hands for an expedition he's undertaking.
He left on an expedition, I ask, and it comes out pinched by disappointment.
Not yet. He's gone to the continent to be married. He sets off for the Barbary States on the 1st of the month to complete some research. You should write to him and say I recommended you. He's less likely to be put off by your sex than the men here in London. He's taken on work with women before.
Of course he has, I want to shout. He's Dr. Alexander Platt, and I have excellent taste in idols. Do you know where I might write him?
He's staying with his intended and her family in Stuttgart. Their uncle's surname is Hoffman, and the bride is... Give me a moment, it will come to me. Josephine? No, that's not it. Joan?
He runs a hand over his chin. Something beginning with a J and an O. My joy turns bloated and sick. When the name of one's only childhood friend is brought up unexpectedly, years' worth of memories you vowed to rid yourself of entirely bob to the surface, particularly when that friendship ended as poorly as ours did. Joanna? I squeak, hoping he'll say otherwise. But he snaps his fingers.
Yes, exactly that. Joanna Hoffman. Very clever of you.
Of course. Of course, another felled tree blocks my path. Of course, the woman marrying Dr. Platt is the last person who'd want to welcome me into her home. Oblivious to my strife, Cheselden goes on.
You might write to Dr. Platt via Miss Hoffman. I know he's intending to set out as soon as the wedding is finished, so you may be too late, but you've no loss dropping a line.
When's the wedding? I ask.
3 weeks from Sunday. Perhaps a bit optimistic for a letter to arrive by then.
It is almost impossible that, in such a short time, my letter could find its way to Dr. Platt, and he would find time amid marriage and planning an expedition to read it, and he would be so taken with my written plea alone that he would offer me a position, and I would then have enough time to travel to wherever he was leaving from and make his acquaintance. An even slimmer chance that any letter bearing my name would not immediately be ripped to shreds by Joanna Hoffman, a girl with whom I have a checkered history as expansive as the list of names upon the walls of the Great Hall. But if it wasn't a letter that showed up on his doorstep, but rather me in the passionate, intelligent flesh, then I might have more of a chance. Dr. Cheselden fishes in his coat pocket for a calling card and hands it to me.
Do tell Alex I advised you to write him.
I will, sir. Thank you.
And Miss Montague, the very best of luck to you.
He touches two fingers to his forehead, then turns down the street, his coat collar turned up against the wind. I wait until he's out of sight before I spin to face Monty and grab his arm, though he's so bundled I mostly get a handful of sweater. Look at that! I told you it all went according to my plan! Monty is looking far less enthusiastic than I'd anticipated. I had even been willing to let him hug me had he offered, but instead he's rubbing the back of his neck with a frown.
That was something.
Try not to sound too excited.
He was bloody patronizing to you.
Much less than anyone else was, and he gave me a card. I wave the creamy stock engraved with Cheselden's name and office address at him, and told me to write to Dr. Platt, the Dr. Alexander Platt. You know, I was telling you about him yesterday at breakfast.
The one who lost his license to practice surgery, he says.
Because he's a radical, I reply. He doesn't think like the other doctors. I'm certain that's why. Monty scuffs his toe against the pavement, eyes downcast. I press the card between my hands like I'm praying over it. I'm going to go to Stuttgart. I have to meet him.
What was that?
Monty's head snaps up.
What happened to writing?
A letter will not get his attention in the way I need to, I reply. I'm going to show up and introduce myself, and he'll be taken with me and offer me the position.
You think you're just going to show up on his doorstep and he's going to hire you?
No, I'm going to go to the wedding and dazzle him with my exceptional promise and work ethic, and then he will hire me. And, I add, though I know this trail is more treacherous, I know Joanna Hoffman. You remember her, don't you?
Of course I do, he replies, but I didn't think you two parted on good terms.
So we had a small falling out, I say, with a flippant wave to undercut the grandness of this understatement. Doesn't mean it won't seem perfectly innocent for me to show up at her wedding. We're friends. I'm celebrating with her.
And how will you pay your way there? He asks. Travel is expensive. London is expensive. Is Dr. Platt going to pay you for this work? Because, as much as Percy and I adore you, sharing our bed is not a long-term living arrangement I am thrilled about. If he had a job for you that was studying medicine or working towards some kind of degree or license, that would be one thing, but it sounds like you'd be taken advantage of.
Well, maybe I'm going to let him take advantage of me. Not like... I blow out a sharp breath, and it comes out wispy and white against the cold air. You know what I mean.
Come on, Felly.
Monty reaches out for my hand, but I pull away. You're too smart for that.
Then what am I supposed to do? I cry,
and it comes out ferocious. I can't give up on medicine, and I can't go back to Edinburgh, and I can't marry Callum. I just can't! The only reason I'm not crying is that I'm so aggravated by the fact that I'm almost crying again. I haven't cried in ages. Even those first grey, lonely weeks in Edinburgh, I had been stiff-lipped and stout-hearted. But in the space of a single hour, I've been on the verge of it three times. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life hiding the things I love behind the covers of books that are considered appropriate for my sex. I want this too much to not try every last damn thing possible to make it happen. Fine. Now you may hug me. He does. It is not my favourite, but if he can't understand the hurt, I can at least let him apply a familiar balm. I stand in his arms, my cheek pressed against the scratchy wool of his coat, and let myself be held.
Everyone wants things, Monty says. Everyone's got a hunger like that. It passes, or it gets easier to live with. It stops eating you up inside.
I scrunch my nose and sniff. Maybe everyone has a hunger like this. Impossible, insatiable, but all-consuming in spite of it all. Maybe the desert dreams of spilling rivers, valleys of a view. Maybe the hunger will one day pass. But if it does, I will be left shelled and halved and hollowed out. And who can live like that?
5. By the next evening, Monty and I have descended from civilised point and counterpoint to full-on bickering on the subject of my going to Stuttgart. It is our only topic of conversation as the three of us walk to the pub in Shadwell called the Minced Nancy, which, from the name alone, brands itself a place where mollies like my brother and his beau can be together openly. We're supping with Scipio and his sailors, whom Monty and Percy have been conspiring for a reunion with since their crew docked several weeks previous. The pavement is narrow, and we walk with me squashed between Monty and Percy, all of us tripping over one another in an attempt to huddle against the cold and also avoid being mowed down by carts. The air reeks of burning pitch from the riverside, so strong I'll be swallowing the smell all night. Soot falls in great clumps as London sets everything that burns aflame to keep warm. Lacking coinage to spare for a lamplighter, our only illumination comes from the spitting spray off the knife grinder's wheels and the blacksmith stamping out their embers for the day as we pass their shops. By the time we find the address,
I'm so tired of being cold and wet and hearing my brother's infuriatingly sensible arguments about why I should not go to Stuttgart on a whim that I'm ready to turn around and return to the flat as soon as we arrive. I expect the club will be crowded, loud and reeking of booze, but it feels more like a coffee house, dark and warm, with oyster shells littering the floor.